ladies and ladies and gentlemen, I hope you've enjoyed your dinner tonight, and thank you so much for coming on this auspicious day after the sevens. I'm glad you all made it through the weekend. I'm Douglas Wong. I'm the first vice president and editor at Bloomberg News, and it's my honor tonight to introduce our speaker, Manu Bhaskaran. Manu is now a partner of the Washington, D.C.-based advisory group Centennial. He's been there since 2001. Before that, he was advising clients on longer-term strategic investments in Southeast Asia and Asia generally for SG Securities, before that with Crosby, and before that with the Singapore government. Tonight, he'll be talking and giving a short slide presentation on Southeast Asia. He has asked me to say that he very much welcomes interventions from the floor, questions. I know that may cause some issues with microphone, but if you'd like to ask questions even before the question and answer session, he's that kind of guy. Without further ado, Manu Bhaskaran.
Good evening. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you, Doug, for that kind introduction. I really meant what Doug said just now. It's going to be a lot more productive, I think, if we are more interactive. So I think it's a small room. I don't think you need a microphone, so please interrupt me at any time with questions, comments, praise, whatever. Yeah. I want to say a bit about Southeast Asia and essentially make an argument that ASEAN, Southeast Asia, whatever you want to call it, is making a comeback of sorts. I think it's one of these ironies that here you have a region that has a record, which is pretty good, of high growth. It's actually a fairly resilient set of economies. They tend to bounce back from crises reasonably well. But it's underperformed, and it's gone off the radar. But now what we're seeing is some structural changes that are creating new drivers of growth, and I think these are very solid drivers of growth, which will, I think, change the picture very decisively, even though this comeback is going to be uneven. It is going to be a bumpy ride, primarily because of political risks, some of which in Thailand you know about, and others which are less evident, and also because there are policy errors, including in countries that are well-managed, like Singapore, which have created problems of our own. Right, which were unnecessary. So, but the bottom line to me still is that ASEAN is likely to surprise on the upside, and let me explain why. Let me start first with some of the pan ASEAN issues, and I'm as a good economist, I'm going to show you some charts. And the essential point I want to make is that, you know, this is a high growth region, right? It's done well compared to most other regions and countries, ex-China and India. This place has done well. But the growth is very volatile because we are highly exposed to global events, and we will, you know, move in sync with that. Why did growth fall after the Asian crisis? Essentially because the investment to GDP ratio fell. For whatever reason, you know, here we were, the darlings of foreign investors and domestic investors through the 80s and 90s, and suddenly there's a stop. And as a result, foreign investment, domestic investment fell. And of course, if you have lower investment, you have lower growth. So why did this happen? It certainly didn't happen because we are not capable of giving investors a high return. This chart is based on data from the United States Department of Commerce. And you know, they give you huge amounts of data. And basically, you can put together data for countries all over the world, how much investment US companies have made in each country, how much profits they make out of that investment each year. So you calculate a rate of return. And basically what this shows is that Southeast Asia has consistently given a superior rate of return to virtually every other region in the world, right? It's only in recent years that China, and now perhaps India, has caught up with Southeast Asia. Southeast Asia's returns fall when the global cycle falls, but it tends to pick up again. On average, Southeast Asia outperforms China, clearly outperforms India. And yet, investors give a much higher share of investment flows and whatever to China and India. So that's a bit of a disjuncture there. Now, is it because somehow Southeast Asian economies could not handle the rise of China and India and were losing out? What this shows is that, you look at the top left, the left-hand chart, China's rising share of global markets. Basically, their rising market share, right? Consistent, huge increase. But look at Southeast Asia next to it. There's no change, virtually no change, in Southeast Asia's share of global exports. In other words, China's increasing market share did not come at the expense of Southeast Asia. It came at the expense of the developed economies like the United States. It came at the expense of Taiwan and Hong Kong. Basically, what I would argue is that it was really the combination of China and Southeast Asia together that became super competitive against the rest of the world. Because basically, it's a supply chain. The multinationals have built this production grid linking supply chains, Southeast Asia into China, and China's the final, the platform where final goods are assembled. Southeast Asia provides the raw materials and the electronic subcomponents and whatever, right? It is that conglomerate together that became super, super competitive. So ASEAN is not doing badly because China is doing well, quite the reverse. The other chart I want to show you is this issue of resilience. A lot of people talk about countries that are exposed to the global economy, and you know that means vulnerability. And vulnerability is not a good thing, right? But my point is that you can be vulnerable, but you can also be resilient. In other words, you may be vulnerable when there's a shock in the global economy, oil prices rise, whatever, you go down, but you are still resilient if you can bounce back very quickly. And this is what a lot of Southeast Asia now has, which it had less of in the 1990s. It is a much more resilient economy in the sense that it is certainly exposed to the global cycle, but we can bounce back very, very quickly. And this is because after the Asian financial crisis, countries like Indonesia, Malaysia, and all that, put a lot of effort into getting the basics right. And if you get the basics right in terms of your public debt, in terms of your fiscal policy, in terms of your monetary policy, and therefore inflationary risks, and you deregulate and so on, basically what you do is you increase the number of shock absorbers in your economy and reduce the number of shock amplifiers in your economy. And that is what improves resilience. So you diversify your economy, you make sure that your banking sector is much better capitalized and regulated, you give the right incentive structure so the company's balance sheets are strong, no mismatches in terms of currencies and maturities or whatever. You build up foreign exchange reserves and so on. And as a result, ex-Vietnam, Southeast Asia has really become very resilient. So yeah, maybe in the next few weeks, something will go wrong between Israel and Iran or whatever. Or, sorry? Oh, yes. He says Hong Kong is down. Well, I don't consider Hong Kong Southeast Asia, but since you asked, why is Hong Kong down? It's basically a function of its role as a funding center. And as a result, the foreign currency loans Hong Kong has in relation to its GDP have increased, and that increases the exposure to some extent. But to me, it's not a big issue because, like Singapore has the same issue as well, if you're a funding center for the region, you will have that problem. The question is whether you can build the other elements of resilience and offset that. In Singapore's case, it was able to do that because it's got fantastic fiscal reserves, and it can utilize that to, you know, reboot the economy should there be a crisis or whatever. But Hong Kong has not done so much as Singapore has.
Sorry, while we're on the subject,
sure.
Resilience?
Okay, resilience basically puts together these shock amplifiers and shock absorbers, right? So basically, we look at how diversified your economy is. If your export base is basically just oil or just, I don't know, copper, then you're going to be very, very vulnerable. And your ability to bounce back is not going to be very good because you depend on just one thing. But if you depend on lots of different products and you export to lots of different countries, where each of which has different cycles, then you are probably more resilient. We look secondly at the capacity of the government to respond, you know, effectively and significantly to a crisis. Look at what China did. You know, within 2 months of September 08, in December 08, it came out with a 4 trillion RMB package. Very few countries can do that. That's resilience. capacity to use monetary policy, exchange rate policy effectively and credibly. If you have a very credible central bank, then you can do it. If you have a central bank that does not have credibility and it cuts rates or it weakens the exchange rate, financial markets will rebel and negate the effect of your policy, right? So credibility of central bank is one of the things we look at. So we look at all these issues and we put it together. We only look at quantifiable data and we put it together in terms of an index, and that's what we get. So that's resilience. Let me move on. So basically, I would argue that Southeast Asian countries have actually adjusted reasonably well to the rise of China and India. As I mentioned, it is China and ASEAN together as a conglomerate that has outperformed the rest of the world. But what's happening now is that the nature of this impact is changing. First of all, China, of course, at the political level is becoming much more assertive, and Southeast Asia has borne the brunt of that in the South China Sea, otherwise known as the West Philippine Sea. And no doubt the Indonesians will call it soon North Borneo Sea or something. But this is a big issue, and it is creating a lot of political changes in Southeast Asia. But it's not a critical issue that will derail our growth or anything like that. The other worry is that China is now building its own supply chains. So the rate of growth of the stuff that we used to import, I mean export to China very successfully, is tailing off. And China, with its vast resources and its huge market, is gaining the scale economies in areas that directly compete now with Southeast Asia. So that's a concern. The good news is that Indian manufacturing is probably going to rise. There is a view that, you know, India's growth is services, China's growth is manufacturing. I think that's completely wrong. I think if you look at the data, Indian manufacturing has played a very strong role in India's growth. The change that's going to happen is that in the past, India was not great for export-oriented manufacturing. It is more domestic-oriented. The big change that's going to happen in the next few years is that India increasingly will become move into the area of export-oriented manufacturing, except that it's not going to be the standard conventional ones where, you know, you start with garments and toys and then move up the value chain. Because of self-inflicted wounds, labor laws and other unnecessary legislation, India is not going to be competitive in those areas, but India is very competitive in precision engineering, engineering-related sectors. So autos, auto parts, those kinds of goods, they are already very competitive. They will increase. Now, what does that mean for Southeast Asia? I think what it means is that the other difference between India and China is that India's manufacturing growth is going to be led by Indian companies. In China's case, export-oriented manufacturing was led by multinational companies that had supply chains already established in Southeast Asia. So as China began to rise, it just started sucking in through the supply chains imports from Southeast Asia, and we benefited together. Now, Indian multinational companies have all their supply chains within India, which makes them uncompetitive because a lot of the components are not produced competitively in India. So what's going to happen in future is that Indian companies, as they globalize, will be forced to build supply chains into Southeast Asia where, you know, you have regions like the southern part of Malaysia, the eastern seaboard of Thailand, which are still globally competitive in the production and export of components, electronic components, electrical components, and the like. So as China's impact changes, India's impact, I think, will become more and more positive in that sense. So that's a big change that, you know, Southeast Asia will have to learn how to deal with, right? But I think overall it'll be positive. So, you know, what is the real problem in ASEAN? I think it's political. I don't think it is really the economic fundamentals that we have to worry about. Investors lost confidence because of a whole series of issues. You had Indonesia basically going into 6-7 years of very, very serious crisis, and then post-crisis recovery was very, very messy. And then you had Malaysia, where you had a prime minister who responded to the crisis by, you know, lashing out at Jews and God knows what else, and you know, reinforced the crisis, imposed capital controls, allegedly to save Malaysia. But apparently, the next day he arrested his own deputy prime minister, and that seemed to be the real reason for the capital controls. And this really, I think, undermined confidence in Southeast Asia as a whole, because here you had the darling of investors in the 1980s suddenly doing things that were completely irrational, and I think it took a long time to recover from that, and Malaysia still has not recovered. Thailand was beginning to do quite well, but you've had, since 2005, a very prolonged political crisis, and that standoff does not seem to likely to end very soon. So political confidence, I think, was clearly an issue. And on top of that, you also have a fairly mixed record in terms of, you know, bringing about the key reforms needed to bring the economies into a much more competitive positioning vis-a-vis China and in future India, or even vis-a-vis other emerging economies that are doing very well now, like Brazil or Turkey or whatever. And this lack of political will is evident in Malaysia, for instance, where clearly rational people know that you have to change, Malaysia has to change the political economy. The affirmative action-based economic regime has to change. Everyone, you know, who knows anything about the economy, including policymakers, know that, but there's no political will to change. In Indonesia, it's done reasonably well. I think it's going to be a good story overall, but if there were the political will to make more reforms in labor market policies, in subsidies and so on, Indonesia should be growing by 8 to 9%, not 6%. And the problem is that you have significant vested interests that will resist new policies successfully, because although we have democratized, and I think we have improved, the democracies in Southeast Asia remain very flawed democracies that are unfortunately only too easily captured by vested interests. So that's the problem, I think. So now, what of the future? What's the good news? I mean, the good news is that if you assume, as I do, that China and India will continue growing, and you know, maybe they will enter a period of somewhat slower growth, and in India's case, probably more volatile growth with a lot of problems, but I think basically you're going to continue to see not just economic growth, but real transformation. If that happens, then the spillover from high growth into Southeast Asia will be largely positive. The demand for commodities and for intermediate goods will continue increasing. There will be more opportunities for tourism, for workers' remittances from receiving countries. The very fact that there is competition that is heating up will force companies in Southeast Asia to hone their act, improve their competitiveness, re-engineer themselves. And I think that's been already a positive, and it'll become more and more of a positive. China moving up the value chain as its costs increase is already a positive. We are seeing footwear industries move from China back to Indonesia, where they were in the 1980s. Bangladesh and Cambodia are benefiting because garment business is moving. So as China moves up the value chain, new opportunities will emerge for the Bangladeshis and Vietnams of this world. It will mean more competition for Thailand, for Malaysia, even for Singapore at some point. But like I said, I think competition is not necessarily a bad thing. If the right responses come through, overall it will be good. The second improvement is this whole process of macro stabilization, of small incremental improvements in the fiscal side, in the regulatory side. And it's small, it's incremental, so people tend to underestimate it. But small changes tend to feed on themselves, especially if they're sustained over time. And this is what happened in India and why a lot of people missed the big surge in India. Basically, India's story was a story of small incremental changes sustained over many years that began to compound each other, and then you reach a point of critical takeoff, and then, boom, you got high growth. So I suspect that something like this has happened in Indonesia, and I also suspect that something like this is going to happen in the Philippines as well. Maybe not as sexy a story as India, but certainly a big surprise on the upside. You're also, you know, despite the fact that reforms have been disappointing, you are seeing some reforms that have had major impacts. The Supreme Court's decision in the Philippines opening up the mining sector has been very significant and very positive. Subsidy rationalization in Malaysia, Indonesia will release fiscal resources to be used more productively that will raise growth. The barriers to infrastructure, which have been has been a huge constraint on growth, are beginning to ease. For instance, the new Land Acquisition Act in Indonesia, I think that's going to precipitate a big surge in spending on toll roads and so on. And the other set of changes is really related to ASEAN integration. Now, it is fashionable to be very cynical about Asian integration. You know, the ASEAN people are talking about an ASEAN economic community by 2015, but if you ask them, is it 1st of January 2015 or 31st December 2015, and they can't give an answer because they don't know. So it's very easy to be cynical, and you'll probably be correct that the rhetoric does not match reality, whether it's ASEAN economic community or whatever. But the very fact that they are pushing forward to this ASEAN economic community, what it means is that there are a lot of changes taking place in terms of harmonization, in terms of standardization, behind the barrier, behind the border, barriers to trade being reduced and so on. And these things will have a powerful impact over time. In addition to that, quite apart from this top-down, ASEAN-down integration, you're seeing new types of integration come through. So, for instance, in the Greater Mekong sub-region, the combination of Japan and the ADB has built a whole set of roads, highways, railways, pipelines that are making the Greater Mekong region, comprising Myanmar, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, and the southernmost provinces of China, into a single economic entity. And that is really beginning to take off now, and I think that's very positive. In Malaysia, another model of cross-border integration is taking place called Iskandar. Malaysia has overcome years and years, and in fact decades of sheer hatred for Singapore, and decided that it's time to do a deal with Singapore. And that deal is that they will hive off this 2,100-kilometer section of Johor, the southern state of Johor, of Malaysia, and basically make it Singapore's Shenzhen. And they're quite happy to do it. Initially, when this was announced, people were very skeptical that it would ever happen. But in the last 2 years, both political leaders have done a deal. And as a result, Iskandar is really taking off. And this year, Iskandar will achieve critical mass. The theme parks, the universities, the schools, the manufacturing, all these things come on stream this year. And I think it's going to be very positive for Singapore, and it's going to be very, very positive for Malaysia as well. So new forms of integration, allowing synergies to be released that will push growth. And finally, Myanmar. Myanmar coming out of the cold is great news for all of Southeast Asia. Quite apart from the diplomatic humiliation of having this sort of stench-filled corpse sort of follow you everywhere and you're trying to pretend it doesn't exist, but you know it does exist, and your main interlocutors, the US, Europe don't want to deal with you because you have this horrible thing, right? And now Myanmar becomes more acceptable. ASEAN gets a better chance at doing deals with Europe on the free trade area and so on, and things begin to move. Also, if you look at the map, Myanmar was the main obstacle between building a proper physical connectivity between India and ASEAN. And once you can get India-ASEAN connectivity up and running, then the synergies from greater trade and investment and other activity flows between India and ASEAN will also be very positive for the region. So, you know, quite apart from Myanmar itself, I think this is a great positive for the region as a whole. I would also say that, again, despite the fact that it hasn't moved fast enough, you are seeing clear signs that at least parts of the political elites in these countries are now prepared to think about fundamental reform. In Indonesia, you've already had a huge process of decentralization, and there's a gradual push for other reforms. Not as much as I would like to see, but still there is a bit of a push. In Singapore, the whole DNA of this society is changing rapidly. We're going to see a totally different model of growth emerge in the next few years. In Malaysia, the current Prime Minister has been quite bold in pushing a new economic model, even to the extent of reviewing race-based affirmative action policies. In Thailand, there's a whole shift in the socio-economic policy model towards more emphasis on the poor, and the Philippines has become much more open than before. These are big changes. So what can go wrong? I come back to politics. And in the short term, I suspect this is going to be a real problem for some of these countries. In Thailand, what you have is really a struggle for the soul of the country. This is not just, you know, Mr. Thaksin versus General Prem, or the military versus civilians, or monarchists versus non-monarchists. This is really a struggle for what kind of democracy Thailand should become. And this is not the kind of fundamental struggle that can be resolved with one or two compromises. This will take many years to resolve. And in the interim, there will be every now and then some kind of crisis. So this is not going to be easy. In Malaysia, you have a situation where the ruling party has structurally lost support. And because there is an ethnic and religious dimension to politics in Malaysia, you must always worry that there could be some occasion where more extreme scenarios could actually materialize. Now, with elections approaching, tensions will rise. I think they will be managed overall, but there's always that nagging fear that something could go wrong. Indonesia is mostly a good story. Unfortunately, there are too many cronies, and they have too... They find it too easy, I think, to influence policy, which I think is a pity. But overall, Indonesia, I think, is still, by and large, a good story. There's also this policy failure. In some countries, like, say, Malaysia, for instance, there's a fiscal time bomb ticking away, and you need, in the next parliament, you will have to see some fundamental changes. And of course, there's the usual problems with infrastructure and education, but I think these things can be managed. Right. So, how are we doing for time? Okay, why don't I just, I have these country-based things, but, I'll just skip that and, take questions, if that's okay with you. I'll just flash what I think was becoming a normal.
Which country you want to hear about?
All of them.
They want to hear you, Manny. They love you.
Massacres.
show us the Malaysian one.
Malaysia one. Right.
Malaysia.
Okay. Malaysia. Okay. Calling this election, which is going to happen, I think, in the next few months, maybe not June, but probably by September, October, is very difficult because both sides have their weaknesses and have their strengths. On the government side, Prime Minister Najib is generally popular, and he has actually swung a lot of Indian votes back to supporting the Barisan Nasional, the ruling coalition, and some of the Malay votes as well. Now, Indian votes generally don't matter in Malaysia, but it's only about 7% of the population. But in a very tightly contested electoral battle, 7 to 8% can really make a big difference. And in some states like Negeri Sembilan and Perak, Indian votes will matter. So this is a big positive for the ruling coalition. There's also been a lot of pump priming, and the Prime Minister has really made a huge personal effort to improve the outlook, the prospects for Barisan Nasional. And yet it's quite clear that the ruling party itself is hesitant, otherwise it would have called an election earlier, right? And this is because there's, I think most people agree that most Chinese, ethnic Chinese voters in Malaysia have, I think now, just fundamentally become alienated from the ruling party and ruling coalition. And if there is a further swing against the Barisan Nasional, which I think is likely, then even states like Johor, Pahang, and the East Malaysian states where Barisan Nasional retains a massive, massive positioning, these could start seeing some losses for the coalition. So that is where the vulnerability is. So what is the most likely result? My suspicion is that it's going to be a very mixed thing where the ruling coalition loses maybe 10 seats, maybe a few more, but these come mainly at the expense of the non-UMNO parties. Basically, it will be the ethnic Chinese parties that are part of the coalition that lose seats to the opposition. But UMNO, which is where the real power in Malaysia lies, the Malay Party, may actually gain one or two seats. It may do well enough to give its leader, Najib, a new lease of life. So it's a very odd situation where the overall coalition does worse, but because his own party does marginally better, he has enough positives to say, look, I've delivered something to you guys. So my suspicion is that he does well enough to remain in power, but unfortunately not strong enough to have the mandate for substantial reform, which is what is needed if Malaysia in the longer term is really to return to the kind of growth and excitement and dynamism that it is actually capable of and which it delivered through the 1970s and 80s and much of the 1990s. So that's Malaysia. Somebody was interested in Myanmar? Well, very quickly on Myanmar, I think this change is for real. I think it's for real because, not because, you know, General Tan Shwe and all have had, you know, on the road to Damascus and saw the light and became Democrats. It is because they made a calculation that continuing with the previous regime would ultimately lose power for them or create a crisis that they would not manage. It also had produced excessive dependence on China, which they found uncomfortable. And the 2007 Monk uprising, I think, shook them. Although they were able to very brutally contain it, I think it shook them, and it made them realize that they couldn't go on doing this. So they had to change. Why is change durable? It's very simple. I think the momentum is building, allowing the moderates in the regime to tell the hardliners, look, a few incremental reforms have actually produced fantastic successes. The payoff to reform is big. And that's why they've been allowed to carry on with the reform process. And you come to a point where enough people are gaining from reforms, the momentum is becoming so strong that the resistance from the hardliners will ebb away. And I suspect that is exactly what's happening. Sanctions are easing, the investment is flooding in, and the currency has actually appreciated significantly. And that's why the regime has allowed the reformers in the government to proceed with the next stage, which is a very risky thing to do, which is currency reform. Currency reform is going to hurt a lot of the vested interests in the regime, but they've decided to bite the bullet and do it. And I think that's an extremely positive development. I explained to you why Myanmar's coming out is actually very good for ASEAN as a whole. Right? You want to talk about Thailand? Okay, very quickly. Like I said, this is a struggle for the soul of the country. So my baseline scenario is that in the short term, you have new tensions, especially when they try to bring Thaksin back to Thailand, which will happen at some point in time. But eventually, there is reconciliation. And I give a very high probability of 60% to that. That's my best guess. You could get another bout of very disruptive protests that just cause this whole standoff to go on for a long time. There's still a fairly high chance of that 30%. And worse still, you could get a return to disorder, the kind of violence you saw on the streets of central Bangkok a couple of years ago, or even a coup. But I think the chances of that happening, I would say, are probably quite small. Right? Why do I say that? I think basically what I sense is that in the mainstream of Thailand, a lot of people are getting very tired of this constant politicking and constant struggle. And I think the where the center of gravity lies in Thai politics is increasingly saying we want some kind of reconciliation. And the extremes on either side will have to take note of that. Thaksin, the monarchists, the military guys, the vested interests in the old business elites, all of these guys will have no choice but to accede to that demand, the pressure coming up from the center of gravity. So I think eventually they will come to some kind of accord. There'll be some kind of compromise. The Thais have done this before. Don't forget, this is not the first time in living memory where they've had to deal with this kind of struggle for the soul of the country. In the 1970s, there was a very similar struggle. There was this swing to democracy, and then a swing to authoritarianism, and then they found a new equilibrium in the 1980s, and it was done in a fairly smooth way, and I think something like that will happen. So overall, longer term, I'm optimistic. Short term, I'm pessimistic. And the other issue, of course, is that the king is aging. He's been in hospital since September 09, so it's a very long time to be in hospital. Clearly, the succession issue is something that generates tensions and uncertainties and unsettles a lot of people. So sometime in the next few years, we will have to deal with this in Thailand, and that's not going to be very good. So that is Thailand in a nutshell.
Manu, if I may say, ladies and gentlemen, I was hoping to wrap up at 9 o'clock tonight to let you go if you wanted. I was going to say that Manu is very willing to stay on and talk to any of you who are interested to talk to him, and he might even talk off the record there and maybe even more insightfully. But as we now have 10 minutes to 9, I don't know whether people, or maybe Manu, you'd like to wrap up and take a few questions.
Fine. Yeah, why not? In a nutshell, basically what I'm saying is that there will be lots of challenges facing ASEAN. there'll be lots of reasons for the pessimist to say that ASEAN continues to, you know, deliver unpleasant surprises or whatever. But my take is that there'll be more than enough positives to offset these negatives, that we are in for a new lease of life, and that ASEAN as an investment destination is going to become a lot more dynamic and a lot more interesting than before. So let me end here, and, you know, very happy to take up.
So we have a few minutes for some questions. If anyone would like to indicate, we'll send a microphone over to you. Over there, Joel.
Thanks. A quick one. Oh.
You could introduce yourself, sir.
It's working. Do you have any slides or commentary on Vietnam that seems to be missing? Vietnam, a country profile in a 30-second elevator speech?
Right. Vietnam, on the supply side, which means longer-term growth potential, it's a fantastic story, right? It's got fantastic demographics, some of the best in the world. It's got human capital that is very impressive, some of the best in the world in terms of potential. It's got large untapped parts of the economy, oil, gas reserves, tourism, low-end manufacturing, agriculture, high-end agriculture, which have not been fully developed and which will be over the next few years. The supply side for Vietnam is extraordinarily good, but they have made one mistake which they are paying for now, which is the failure to get the financial dimension of the economy right. You know, how you manage inflation, how you manage the banking sector, all those things. So as a result, you've got this problem with the current account deficit, with high inflation, overheating, currency is weak. The central bank has not been good at monetary policy. It's not been good at supervising the banks. Now there's a big change. They've appointed a new set of people to manage the central bank. They're beginning to do the right things. They're getting a lot of help from the ADB, the IMF, Japan, and they have avoided the crisis which many thought was imminent last year. So they've bought time. I still think it's going to take a while because they have to clean up the non-performing loans. They have to strengthen the banks. They have to deal with the state enterprises that have taken on too much debt and misused that debt. They have a huge agenda of things to clean up, and that's going to take a while. My guess is that they will do it. And I think the longer-term story for Vietnam is extremely positive, but in the short term, I would hesitate to put money there right now. I took more than 30 seconds, sorry.
Okay, Vodine, England.
Hi, Vodine, England here, hi. For people outside the region, do they look at ASEAN as a lump, as a group area for investing, or indeed should they? Or does it make more sense to look at an individual country for a particular thing?
Well, so far it's been the way things work. You look at different countries as individuals, right? But my view is that even with the slowness in getting real integration off the ground, by 2020, I mean, if you're a multinational company, if you're a consumer, fast-moving consumer goods company, you're an airline, you're selling transportation equipment, whatever, you are increasingly going to look at ASEAN as one single market. And I don't mean all of ASEAN. I mean the core ASEAN economies of Thailand, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, Philippines, maybe Brunei, and increasingly Vietnam. They will be seen as one. The rest will take a little longer to come into and be integrated. But, you know, as it is today, if you buy a bottle of shampoo, not all the bottles of shampoo, but you buy a bottle of shampoo, say in Singapore, Malaysia, you turn back and you'll see on it stuff written in Thai, in Bahasa, and in English. Clearly, it's being marketed across the region. So certain types of fast-moving goods, consumer goods, it's already happening. For the auto sector, it will happen. For the airline sector, it will happen. I mean, it's done. It's in the pipeline. And, you know, this subset of industries where you have no choice but to look at it as a region will increase.
Yes, Jane Singer with Inside Fashion. I'm just wondering, from your point of view, what impact on the growth and development of ASEAN do you feel the current sluggish economies in the West will have? I mean, I understand the stated intention is to become more domestically driven. I mean, China's, of course, stated that, but still, there's a fairly long transition time for that happening, and it also appears economically that the West is going through a fairly long, you know, downturn in terms of importing.
That's definitely a problem, because that means that overall global growth will be sluggish, and you know, we like to think that we are very integrated into China, but if you analyze exports, so-called intra-Asian exports, what you'll find is that about two-thirds of so-called intra-Asian trade is really trade centered around the supply chain to supply stuff to the export platform in China, which eventually meets consumer demand not in China, but in the US, Japan, and Europe, actually mostly US and Europe. So this intra-Asian trade is not a reason to say that somehow we are more dependent on ourselves and less dependent on the so-called G3 economies. That has not happened yet. So sluggish growth means slower growth in global demand, which is a strong headwind for countries in the region, less so for Indonesia, very much so for Singapore and Malaysia.
Yeah, you've said that one of the problems of real political risk in the region is what you call flawed democracies. So I wondered if you could tell us which countries in Southeast Asia you would regard as democratic, and what some of their flaws might be, and do you think that maybe authoritarian politics might be a better way to go to resolve some of these problems?
I read the Straits Times religiously, and I'm very sure that Singapore is a perfect democracy. Actually, all these countries are changing, and overall for the better, in terms of democratization. But democracies, there's no perfect democracy. I mean, even the United States, even Europe, you just have this scandal in the UK where the second treasurer of the Conservative Party was selling access to the Prime Minister in exchange for funds, right? So you have this problem, right? It is somehow democracies have not found a way to prevent vested interests from capturing key departments of the state. Financial sector reform in the West has been a huge disappointment for that reason, right? So that's the context. Now, within that, it's still very disappointing what you're seeing in Indonesia. I think Indonesia, as I said, really should be growing by 8-9% per annum. And the difference between a country growing at 6% per annum and 8-9% per annum is actually a lot more than 2-3 percentage points. Because once you start growing at 8-9%, unemployment starts to come down decisively, wages start to shoot up, and the lower 20-25% of the population, which doesn't really benefit that much from 6% growth, really starts to benefit. So if you want transformation that delivers welfare benefits to the average, the ordinary folks, you need to grow at that rapid rate. And it is very sad that the, and it's not just the president in Indonesia, it is the whole system is failing the people of Indonesia, I think, right? So I that's the main area where I have some concern, where vested interests. The other is, of course, the Philippines. That's well known. I think Congress and the instruments of state are too easily influenced by vested interests within the Philippines, and that has inhibited Philippine growth. And I think that's well known. I don't have to go through it. So those are the two places I would highlight. As I said, Singapore is perfect, so there's nothing to worry about.
Ladies and gentlemen, it's 9 o'clock. I saw one more question. If people would like to stay for the one question, or and then also once again, as Manu, as I said earlier, Manu is very happy to meet any of you who have further questions. I think he's a. I'll be buying him a drink at the bar later, so if you don't have to rush off, just the final question then.
Following on from what you were saying just now, I think it was about 2 months ago, I think it was Michael Richardson from Institute of Southeast Asian Studies wrote into the letters to The Economist saying one of the big drivers of growth recently in Southeast Asia has been the increasing willingness of the family-run corporations that dominate a lot of Southeast Asia to forego some of those rent-seeking activities that have sort of hindered that. So, I mean, do you agree with that broadly, and do you have any sort of concrete examples of that?
I know Michael quite well, but I don't remember this article, so I haven't read it, so I'm not
sure. It was the letters to The Economist, wasn't it? He was talking about Myanmar, but he framed it in the whole broader ASEAN context and sort of
for,
what's
for
going
Myanmar,
on.
It's very clear. I think it's an easier decision in Myanmar because obviously if you grow the size of the cake, there's just so much more wealth that you can take a share of, right? I think it's less clear elsewhere. So I'm not sure. I haven't read his article, so I'm really not sure what to address there. But if you look at each of these countries, I think there is still resistance to change, right? What is happening is that many of the elites, the business and political elites, realize that there is a problem, right? That if you continue on the current path, it is not going to be good for anyone. So there has to be change. So intellectually, a lot of these guys have accepted at the policy level, at the business associations, family level, they have accepted that there is a need for change. The problem comes when you have the details of change and the pace of that change. So if Michael was referring to that intellectual decision, that intellectual realization that needs to be changed, I agree with him. But when it comes to the actual details of what to implement, when to implement, and how effectively to implement these things, that's where the problem, I think, still is in countries like Indonesia and Philippines. Having said that, you know, these countries do have shown a remarkable capacity to reinvent themselves. I mean, look at Thailand. When I first started covering Thailand as an economist 20-something years ago, everyone was convinced that the Thai economic miracle would not last because the HIV infection rate was high and they would all crawl home to their huts and die, that, you know, education was bad, skill shortage, and infrastructure. Well, Thailand was able to reinvent itself despite a horrible economic and financial crisis. You have an auto industry, an auto parts industry, and now you have a third wave of auto-related industries coming into Thailand that are basically servicing the auto parts industry. So Thailand has shown a capacity to reinvent itself, to do enough changes which involve some sacrifice on the part of the current powers that be to push the system along. So the way I would look at it is, you know, the glass is half full. But I would be more country specific in the way I look at this issue.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you again for your fantastic questions, for coming along tonight, and thank you, of course, Manu, for making it all possible.
Thank you.
No, we always do. What did you think of the question?